Chapter 2. In front of Al's motor sales, Al Miller walked back and forth, his hands in his pockets.
I knew he would, Al thought.
Sooner or later.
He couldn't just turn it over to someone else to run. Once he couldn't run it himself, he had to dump it. What now?
He asked himself. I can't patch those old jalopies up without him. I'm not that good. I'm a tinkerer, not a mechanic. He turned and faced his lot and the 12 cars on it.
What are they worth?
He asked himself. On the windshields he had written in white poster paint various enticing statements. Full price, $59. Good tires. And Buick, automatic shift, $75. Spotlight, heater, make offer. Runs good, seat covers, $100.
His best car, a Chevrolet, was only worth $150.
Junk, he thought. They ought to be scrapped for the parts, not safe on the road. Next to a 49 Studebaker, the battery charger worked away, recharging, its black wires disappearing into the open hood of the car.
It takes that to start them up, he realized. A portable battery charger.
The batteries, half of them won't hold a charge all night. They're down in the morning.
Each morning when he arrived at the lot, he had to get into each car and start it up and run the motor. Otherwise, when someone came to look, he would have nothing running to show them.
I ought to call Julie, he said to himself. This was Monday, so she was not at work.
He started toward the entrance of the garage, but then halted.
How can I talk from there? He asked himself. But if he crossed the street to the cafe and phoned from there, it would cost him 10 cents. The old man always let him use the garage phone free, and so it was hard to face the idea of paying out 10 cents.
I'll wait, he decided, until she shows up here at the lot.
At 11:30, his wife drew up to the curb in a lot car, an old Dodge with the upholstery hanging from the roof, its fenders rusted and its front end out of alignment. She smiled at him cheerfully as she parked.
Don't look so happy, he said.
Does everybody have to be as gloomy as you?
Julie said as she hopped out of the car. She had on faded jeans, and her long legs looked thin. Her hair was tied back in a ponytail. In the midday sunlight, her freckled, slightly orange-colored face beamed its usual confidence. Her eyes danced as she strode toward him, her purse under her arm.
Have you had lunch?
She said.
Al said, The old man sold the garage. I have to close up the lot.
He heard his tone. It was as dire as possible. It was obvious, even to him, that he wanted to destroy her mood. He did it without guilt, too.
So don't be so jolly, he said. Let's be realistic. I can't keep these heaps working without Ferguson. Christ, what do I know about car repair? I'm just a salesman.
In his most depressed moods, he thought of himself that way, as a used car salesman.
Who'd he sell it to?
She said. Her smile remained, but it was cautious now.
I couldn't tell you, he said.
She started at once toward the entrance of the garage.
I'll ask, she said. I'll find out what they're going to do. You don't have sense enough to find out.
She disappeared inside the garage. Should he follow her? He did not feel much like seeing the old man again. But on the other hand, it was his job to discuss the thing, not his wife's. So he followed along, knowing that her quick, long-legged stride would get her inside well before him. And sure enough, when he entered the garage, and his eyes had had time to adjust to the dim light, he found her standing with the old man in conversation. Neither paid him any attention as he came slowly up. Speaking in his usual hoarse, low voice, the old man was explaining what he had explained to Al. He went over the same ground in almost the same words, as if, Al thought, it was a set speech he had put together. The old man told her that the choice was not his, as she well knew, because his doctor had told him he could no longer do the heavy kind of work that auto repairing entailed, and so forth.
Al listened without interest, standing so that he would look outside at the bright midday street and the cars and people going by.
"Well, I'll tell you what I think,"
Julie said in her brisk voice.
"This might turn out to be a good thing, because possibly now he can go back to school."
At that, Al said, "Christ." The old man regarded him, rubbing his right eye, which had become red and swollen. It had something in it, evidently. Reaching into his hip pocket, he brought out a large handkerchief and began touching the corner of it to his eye. He regarded both Al and Julie with what seemed to Al to be cunning and nervousness mixed together. The old man had made up his mind. He had decided on his position, not only regarding his garage, but regarding the two of them. Whether he felt he had done right or not by them did not matter. He would not budge. Al knew him well enough to know that. The old man was too stubborn. Even Julie, with her authoritative tongue, couldn't affect him.
"I tell you," the old man mumbled, "it's a lousy life working in this damp, drafty place. It's a wonder I didn't die years ago. I'll be glad to get out of here. I deserve a vacation."
Julie said, her arms folded,
"You could have included a stipulation in the sale that the new owner had to continue the lease of the lot to my husband for the same figure."
Ducking his head, the old man said,
"Well, I don't know. That's up to my broker. I'll let him handle all that."
His wife's face had become red. Al had rarely seen her as angry as this. Her hands were shaking. And that was why she had folded her arms. She was hiding her hands.
"Listen," she said in a high-pitched voice, "why don't you just die and will the garage to Al? I mean, you don't have any children, any family."
She was silent then, as if Al thought she knew she had said something bad. And it was bad, he thought. It was unfair. The garage was the old man's. But, of course, Julie would never admit that. She would not be bound by facts.
Come on,
Al said to her. Taking hold of her arm, he forcibly moved her away from the old man, who was mumbling something in answer, toward the entrance and the street.
"It makes me so furious," she said as they came out into the sunlight. "He's really senile."
"Senile hell," Al said. "He's a smart old man." "Like an animal," she said, "without regard to others."
"He's done a lot for me," he said. "If you sold all the cars on the lot," she said, "how much would you get?"
"About $500,
he said. "But it would be a little more than that."
"I can go back on full time," she said. Al said, "I'll shop around for another location." "You told me you couldn't do it without his help," she said. "You said you don't have enough capital to buy cars that you can put up for sale." "But then I'll make a deal with another garage," Al said. Julie said, "This is the time for you to go back to school."
She halted and faced him firmly. In her mind, he needed a college degree. He needed to go 3 more years. He had gone to the University of California for 1 year, and then he would be able to get what she called a good job. His degree would be in a practical subject. Business administration had been her choice. In his 1 year, he had had no major. He had taken only a general course, a little of this and that. It had not appealed to him, and so he had not gone back. For one thing, he did not like to be indoors. Perhaps that was why the used car business attracted him. He could be outside all day long in the sun. And, of course, he was his own boss. He could come and go as he pleased. He could open the lot at 8 or 9 or 10, go to lunch at 1 or 2 or 3. Stay half an hour, or a whole hour, or even eat his lunch in one of the cars. He had built a little building in the center of the lot out of basalt blocks. It had aluminum window units, which he had picked up wholesale. In fact, the wiring, too, had come wholesale, and the roofing, as well as the fixtures. It was almost a house, and he thought of it as such, a house he had built with his own hands,
which belonged to him, in which he could go whenever he wanted and stay out of sight as long as he wanted. In it, he had an electric heater, a desk, a file cabinet. He had magazines to read, and his business papers. Sometimes he had a typewriter, which he rented at $5 a month. Formerly, he had had a phone, but that was gone for good. If he moved, if he gave up the lot, he would take the house with him. It belonged to him. It was his personal property, as were the cars. Unlike the cars, it was not for sale. One other object which was not for sale and which belonged to him would go along, too. Like the house, he had built it. In the rear of the lot, out of sight, he had a car he had been working on for months. When he had any spare time, he turned to it. The car was a 1932 Marmon. It had 16 cylinders, and it weighed over 5,000 pounds. In the days when it had been in running condition, it had gone up to 107 miles an hour. It had been, in fact, one of the finest autos in the United States, and it had originally cost $5,500. A year ago, Al had come across the old Marmon in a shed. Its condition was deplorable, and he had, after several weeks of haggling, been able to pick up the car for $150, including two extra tires. From what he knew about cars, he believed that when it was fully restored, the Marmon would be worth between $2,500 and $3,000. So at the time, it had seemed to be a good investment. But for the past year, he had been at work on the task of restoration, and it was by no means finished. One afternoon, while he had been working on the Marmon, he had looked up to see two colored men standing watching him. A good deal of the sidewalk traffic on the street was colored, and he sold as many cars to Negroes as to whites.
"Hey,"
he said. One of the Negroes nodded.
"What that?"
the other asked.
Al said, "A 1932 Marmon."
"Man," the taller of the two Negroes said. Both men were young. They wore sports coats and white shirts, without ties, and dark slacks. Both seemed well-groomed. One smoked a cigarette, the taller one who had spoken.
"Listen," he said. "Maybe I bring my father to look at that. He likes something like that, drive him in when he got to go to visit in Florida."
The other Negro said,
"Yeah, he old dad liked to ride in a car like that. We go get him, you see."
Getting to his feet, Al said,
"This is a collector's car."
He then tried to explain to them that the car was not for sale, at least not in the terms that they would understand. This was not transportation, he explained. This was a treasured heritage from the past, one of the superb old touring cars, in some ways the finest of them all. And as he talked, he saw that, as a matter of fact, they did understand. They understood perfectly. It was just what the taller Negro's old dad wanted to ride to Florida in. And thinking about it, Al could see their point. It was just that this car was almost 30 years old and not in running condition. It had not run, in fact, since before World War II. The taller Negro said,
"You get that old car to run, and maybe we buy it from you."
Both men were very grave. They nodded again and again.
"How much you want?"
the taller Negro asked.
"What you asking for that car once you get it running again?"
Al said,
"About $3,000.
And that certainly was the truth. That was what it was worth. Neither of the two men batted an eye.
"That about right,"
the taller said, nodding. They exchanged glances, both nodding.
"That about what we expect to pay," the taller Negro said. "Naturally, we not pay that all at once. We work through our bank." "That's so,"
the other agreed.
"We put about, say, 600 down and the rest on time payment."
The two Negroes left presently, again telling him they would return with the taller Negro's father. Naturally, he had not expected ever to see them again. But sure enough, the next day, there they were again.
This time they had with them a short, stout old Negro with vest and silver watch chain and shiny black shoes. The two younger men showed him the Marmon and explained, more or less, the situation that Al had put forth. After deliberation, the old man had come to the conclusion that the car would not do after all, and for what seemed to Al to be a supremely logical reason. The old man did not think that they would have much luck finding tires for it, especially along the highway between major towns. So, in the end, the old man thanked him very formally and declined the car. The encounter had stuck in Al's mind, possibly because after that he had seen a good deal of this particular group of Negroes. They were a family named Doolittle, and the old gentleman with the vest and silver watch chain was well-to-do, or at least his wife was. Mrs. Doolittle owned rooming houses and apartment buildings in Oakland. Some of them were in white neighborhoods, and she rented through a building custodian to whites. He had found out about this from the two younger men, and after a time he had been able to get a much better apartment for himself and Julie through these people. He and she were living there now, in a renovated three-story wooden building on 56th Street near San Pablo. They had the upper floor, and it only cost them $35 a month. The reason for the low rent lay in two conditions. First, this particular building was in a non-exclusive neighborhood, which meant that there was a Negro family on the bottom floor and a Mexican boy and girl with their baby on the top floor. It did not bother him to live in the same building with Negroes and Mexicans, but the other condition did bother him. The wiring and the plumbing in the building were so bad that the Oakland City inspectors were on the verge of condemning the building. Sometimes shorts in the walls kept the power off for several days. When Julie ironed, the wall heated up too hot to be touched. All of the people in the building believed that eventually the building would burn to the ground. But most of them were out of it during the day, and they seemed to feel that because of that they were somehow safe. Once the bottom of the hot water heater rusted through and water leaked out, snuffing out the gas jets and spilling across the floor so that it ruined most of Julie's rugs and furnishings. Mrs. Doolittle refused to make any sort of refund to them. They had all gone without hot water for almost a month, until at last Mrs. Doolittle had found some part-time plumber who could put in another worn-out hot water heater for $10 or $11. She had a staff of inferior workmen who could patch up the building just enough to keep the city from closing it on the spot. They kept it going day by day. It was her hope, he heard, to sell it eventually, to be torn down. She thought that a parking lot might go in. There was a supermarket around the corner which was interested. The Doolittles were the first middle-class Negroes that he had ever known or even heard of. They owned more property than anyone else that he had met since coming to the Bay Area from St. Helena, and Mrs. Doolittle, who personally ran the string of rental properties, was as mean and stingy as other landladies that he had run up against. Being a Negro had not made her any more humanitarian. She did not discriminate among the races. She ill-used all her tenants, white and dark alike. Mr. McKechnie, the Negro on the floor below, told him that she had originally been a schoolteacher. Certainly she looked like it. She was a tiny, sharp-eyed, gray-haired old woman, wearing a long coat, hat, gloves, dark stockings, and high heels. It always looked to him as if she were dressed for church. From time to time she had terrible fights with other tenants in the building, and her shrill, loud voice issued up from the floorboards or down from the ceiling, whichever place she was. Julie was afraid of her, and always let him deal with her. Mrs. Doolittle did not scare him, but she gave him something to ponder, the effect of property on the human soul. Contrarily, the McKechnies downstairs owned nothing. They rented a piano, and Mrs. McKechnie, who seemed to be in her late 50s, was learning to play on her own, from a book. John Thompson's First Grade Piano Book. Late at night, he heard Boccherini's Minuet, again and again, played deliberately, all notes getting equal emphasis. During the day, Mr. McKechnie sat outdoors in front of the building,
on an apple crate which he had painted green. Later, someone provided him with a chair, probably the big German used furniture merchant down the street. Mr. McKechnie sat for hours on end, nodding and saying hello to everyone who passed. At first, Al was mystified by the McKechnie's ability to survive economically. He could not make out any source of income. Mr. McKechnie never left the house, and although Mrs. McKechnie was gone a good deal of the time, it was always for shopping or visiting friends or doing good works in the church. Later on, however, he learned that their children, who had grown up and left home, supported them. They lived, Mr. McKechnie told him proudly, on $85 a month. The little McKechnie grandson, when he came to visit, played by himself on the sidewalk or in the vacant lot at the corner. He never joined in with the gangs of kids who lived in the neighborhood year-round. His name was Earl. He made almost no noise, scarcely talking even to the adults. At 8 a.m, he would appear wearing wool trousers and a sweater, with a grave expression on his face. He had very light skin, and Al guessed that he was heir to a good deal of white blood. The McKechnies left him to their own devices, and he seemed responsible enough. He kept out of the street and never set fire to anything, as did most of the neighborhood kids, white and colored and Mexican. In fact, he seemed a cut above them, even aristocratic, and Al occasionally pondered as to his probable background. Only once did he hear Earl raise his voice in anger. Across the street, two bullet-headed white boys lived, both bullies with time on their hands. They were the same age as Earl. When the mood came onto them, they gathered green fruit, bottles, stones, and clods of dirt, and hurled them across the street at Earl, who stood silently on his sidewalk before his house. One day Al heard them yelling in their chilling voices,
"Hey, you got an ugly mama!"
They repeated that again and again, while Earl stood glowering silently back at them, his hands stuck in his pockets, his face becoming more and more stern. At last, the taunts drove him to answer. In a loud, deep voice, he shouted,
"Take care, little boys. Take care, little fellas there."
It seemed to do it. The white boys went off. Recollections, thoughts filled Al's mind. The people who came to look at cars on his lot, kids without money, workmen who needed transportation, young couples. As he stood there in front of the garage with his wife, he thought about them, not about what she was saying. She was speaking to him now about her own job as secretary at Western Carbon and Carbide. She was recalling to him her desire to quit entirely someday. He would have to be making a lot more money for her to do that.
"You're hiding from life," Julie wound up. "You're looking at life through a tiny hole."
"Huh? Maybe so," he said, feeling glum.
"Off here in this run-down district?"
She gestured at the street of small stores, the barber shop, the bakery, the loan company, the bar across the street. The Colon irrigation outfit, whose sign always upset her.
"And I don't think I can stand living in that ratty apartment much longer, Al."
Her voice had softened.
"But I don't want to put pressure on you."
"Okay," he said. "Maybe what I need is to get my colon irrigated," he said. "Whatever that is."